Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Hey guys, welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a really amazing episode, you know, that we have ahead of us, you know, with a European founder. And obviously I'm a little bit biased, you know, being European too, but we have ahead of us, you know, it's going to be a tremendous episode, very inspiring. We're going to be talking about building, scaling, financing, all of that good stuff. Then also, you know, our guest today not only has built unicorn companies and now his current baby, which is a rocket ship. We're going to be talking about that too. He's raised quite a bit of money for that as well. But the first one obviously didn't pan out, you know, so obviously as we know, you either succeed or you learn. And there's going to be tons of lessons that we're going to be discussing today with you all. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Jordan Julie. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Very happy to be here.
So originally born and raised in Paris. So give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up?
Yeah, so, you know, growing up in Paris, it was, so first of all, gray, right? As the weather is mostly gray. Then it was pretty interesting from a student standpoint. You know, you go to public school because in France, you know, it's where you go. Then I managed to enter one of the great engineering schools that is also in near Paris. And then I had the opportunity as soon as possible to study abroad and to be able to live abroad. So I've done a bit of work in London, and then I studied in the Silicon Valley in Stanford. And so I was able to compare, I would say, the two education models.
To compare notes. Eh? But one thing that is very important that you're missing, you know, that we got to touch on is the fact that your parents were also entrepreneurs. And you saw them building and scaling their own business. You know, basically they were doing on-premise software for banks. But I'm wondering, you know, this is really incredible because obviously in Europe, now this is changing. But the mentality, especially back then, it was either you would finish school and you would become a banker or a lawyer or a doctor or a consultant, right? But really becoming an entrepreneur it hasn't been that well received until, you know, very recently. So how was, you know, the journey of you being able to experience your parents, you know, like really going through the cycles and the emotions also of being founders themselves?
Yeah, so both my parents, they launched their company. It was in 95. So we were I was like 6 years old, and my little sister were four. And they worked together. So they took a big risk, you know, as parents, as a family, to kind of you know, dive into entrepreneurship, quit your salary jobs to try to launch your thing. So They took definitely big risks. And at first, I remember that when we visited the first office of this company, you know, it was like you could barely, you know, fit four people in there. So that was like very, very small. And then eventually we were lucky enough that the company, you know, worked pretty well. So they started selling, you know, kind of I would say back office solutions for regional banks. You know, they signed one bank, then two, then 10, etc. So we kind of lived with my sister with, I would say, the expansion of this company that eventually allowed us to move up the social ladder. And so that was very inspiring. We were like moving flats every 3 years. And it was only like a bigger apartment, so that was nice. And you know, at dinner, like the family dinners, it was more about like, you know, discussing the business, the people problems, the customer stuff, etc., rather than, you know, talking about schools or things like that. So I have this kind of model where with entrepreneurship, you can build your own freedom. And you can like build the stuff how you want to do it, and that you can like enjoy yourself a lot while keeping a pretty good, I would say, family work balance. So that was definitely pretty inspiring. And maybe last thing to say, that it was a fully it was a self-funded model. So 100% profitable. They had like huge, pretty good gross margin. So on that part as well, being a founder of like venture-backed companies, I see that how hard it is to generate, profitability. And that's one of the main topics for 2024. So yeah, I have a lot of, admiration for their path.
So in your case, you, as you were saying, you landed in Stanford, Silicon Valley. You know, you were obviously experiencing the land of innovation, right? I mean, it's just unbelievable there. Now, I guess for you, how was that experience like?
So both my parents are engineers, so I don't have any credit into picking engineering schools. Then what I wanted to do was to be like a banker, like a trader or a quant analyst. You know, I saw the movie Wall Street, that you know, you have like all the traders in New York City. I thought, okay, that's very exciting. I did my first internship at the City of London, which was great, and then I landed at Stanford, to study financial mathematics, to eventually come back to work at UBS, it was. But when you land, in California and especially at Stanford, like most of your classes are about computer science, or that's actually what they teach best. You know, some of the teachers are like, I had a class with Peter Thiel, I had a class with Sam Altman, I had a class with the first, business angel investors in Google. So those are pretty inspiring guys. What they tell you is that you should try and launch your startup and build your ideas, etc. To live the experience. So at the end of my studies, when I came back to France, it was kind of obvious that I wanted to try, having also in mind that I have this family context of entrepreneurs. So I didn't have any choice but to try.
So then, talking about trying, the first company, that comes knocking, that is Rebbe, I believed, no? And Rebbe. So how did you guys, go about this? Because obviously it's the first rodeo, it's your first day company. And obviously it wasn't the outcome that you guys had hoped for too. So I'm sure that the lessons there were absolutely unbelievable. So walk us through, what was that journey of launching the business and what happened? Because it was pre-product market fit when the failure, occurred.
So when I came back to France, it was early 2013. Basically, since then, I had like four professional experiences, the four of them in startups and three as a co-founder. So the first one was Rebel right after school with my best friend from school, actually. So we came back from Stanford, the two of us, we were like, okay, so we followed the entrepreneurship, classes, etc. We know how to code. So obviously we are going to launch something. We explored, a bunch of industries, and we landed into the newspaper industry, in a sense that we thought that, it was an industry with like huge transformations. So we were like, okay, there is probably some room for two people that know nothing about the industry and be able to build some stuff in it. That was obviously, pretty presumptuous. We did every mistake, possible mistake. So we spent the first 6 months doing a business plan without leaving the room. So we were like reading articles, theorizing about the future of newspaper, and then we build like a business plan that was eventually completely useless. Then we spend like about 6 months, building a product without talking to anybody. That was also like a bad thing. And then we spend the remaining 6 months try to gather users and applying to incubators without any business model. And so we got declined from like 1, 2, 3, 4 incubators. And at the fifth one, when the guys, told us, but you don't have any business model. And we were like, yeah, but why do we need to have one? You have like the Facebook and Twitters that don't have any business model. They just scale and it's good. It's good enough, right? And plus we came from Stanford, so you should trust us, right? When they say no, because our business was crap and they were right, then we decided to kind of, stop. And I would say the few learnings that we have is that, so the two of us, we were not like complementary enough, my friends and I. We are both like, I would say product-ish guys, wanted to code stuff, and we didn't go out, in the street to try to sell the business before building it. So that was, I think, the biggest mistake.
So I guess in that regard, as they say, once an entrepreneur, always an entrepreneur. Now, in your case, it happened with Spendesk. So what do you think needed to happen for you to all of a sudden land in the opportunity and what was possible with Spendesk, and how hard it was, to go at it again? Because obviously the first experience was not so, not the desired outcome. It wasn't as positive as you had hoped for, but how did you really build yourself up to go and do it again?
So I think one of the toughest thing, for this experience, it's not the fact that we failed in a sense that we didn't find like product market fit, we didn't have like a lot of users nor revenues. It's more, I would say, the opportunity cost. Because while you are trying to build your, I would say, like shitty business, you have your friends that started their careers in banks, in consulting, and they're starting to make good money. And they're like, but why are you using your time, Jordan, on this like stupid, blog stuff? So at the end of it, your self-confidence, it's kind of, is at its lowest. So you need to kind of refill, I would say, in terms of like energy and self-confidence to try again. So I did that by joining, I would say, a company as first product manager for about 2 years. And this company was initially co-founded by like some very big guys, super experienced guys. So I was like, as a 25 years old guy, I would be able to work with some people that they know where they want to, they know what they want to do, they know where they're going to move the business. So I'm going to be able to learn a ton from them. And so I worked with them for about 2 years. And at the end of it, I was like, okay, so I think it's super like, I learned a lot, but I disagree with some things in terms of like how they approach product, how they approach company culture. And I feel that I have the feeling that I really want to kind of, dive again. And be able to not only build a product, but also like build a company culture that would value, a bit more, would say transparency, etc. And in that context, I kind of, started looking for new potential co-founders. And then you get to meet people and then you get excited about stuff. And so I got excited with those guys that were starting to build virtual credit cards for businesses. I was like, okay, the fact that it's virtual, it's good. The fact that it's going to touch like payments, finance, etc., it's at the crossroad of what I know. Let's try. But it was a very uneducated decision.
I hear you. So then I guess for the people that are listening to really get it, what ended up being the business model of Spendesk?
Yeah, so we launched Spendesk. So I joined as a late co-founder and head of product there, so in charge of building, I would say, the features, the softwares, and also the fintech related stuff. And basically, Spendesk product, can you hear me? It cuts a bit. Yeah. Spendesk product is a spend management software. So we were working with SMEs all across Europe, and help them better manage their purchases. So we would issue credit cards for their employees, and then you have a software to manage approval flows, do your bookkeeping, keep your budgets, all this kind of stuff. And so we grew from like 3 to 200 employees when I left 4 years later, and today Spendesk it's the 25th French unicorn. So pretty big thing. But when I left, it was not a unicorn yet. So I left too early.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So what do you think were the key ingredients for Spendesk to make it so big like that?
Yeah, so first of all, I think we had like a true, I would say, a true innovative product. So before us, you had like expense management solutions, which were like pretty like pure software. Then you had like corporate cards, which were like pure cards from banks and etc. And we kind of mixed the two. So we embedded cards into an expense management software. And this completely shifted the user experience. It completely shifted the business model as well. And so back to your question, the business model was very interesting. It was a mix of a SaaS subscription, like very very high margin, very recurring, etc., and a mix of revenues from payments, which is like a very correlated with usage, and so the fact that we had like a two-leg business model made the company like very interesting from a like a VC standpoint, and so we managed to kind of raise a lot of money, and then we invested this money into like more product, I would say, development. But also, I would say, a bigger acquisition machine. And on that second part, I think this is also what explains the success of Spendesk, is that we built like a super efficient B2B sales acquisition machine. And so, yeah, we were able to sign a lot of deals and to offer a very nice user experience.
So it sounds like the company was going amazing. You know, ended up becoming a unicorn. You know, and being the founder of a company like that is pretty unbelievable. So I guess what made you want to look for greener pastures?
So I left Spendesk mid 2020. So we were post Series B, 200 people in the team. We raised like more than 50 million euros. Like growing a lot. And I basically left. I think that's because I was, when I joined as early founder, my goal was to, since I didn't manage to do it with Dribble, it was to reach like, you know, product market fit and to do like Series A. And once we achieved those goals, I kind of did not really like actualize my personal goals. So after the Series B, I was like, you know, I reached my personal goals. What's next for me? And then I would say that post Series B, you know, the challenges are much more around like scaling the business, scaling the organization, building, I would say, hiring machines, building career path machines, etc. And that was, I would say, that were challenges where I had a bit less of a fit on a personal note, and so less of an impact as a co-founder. And so I was like, okay, I think it's time for me to move on.
So then what did that look like, you know, turning the page?
So first of all, I felt, so it was very empty. You know, so one day, like you're I would say, you know, investing 200% of your time, of your energy, etc., all you have into this business. And then the next day you're alone, you know, like playing video games, at your home. So because I didn't leave Spendesk to build something else, I just left.
So then walk us through what was the, that journey like, you know, all the way to obviously landing with DeFacto, which is, you know, your latest company. What was that journey like, you know, to all of a sudden figuring out what that next chapter would be?
Yeah, so first of all, I took like 6 months off, completely off, not thinking about like a next business, but really like digest the learnings. I kind of refill, you know, the energy levels, that I think is super important, you know, as entrepreneur to really have like good energy levels. So I tried to kind of, write first of all some of the learnings, my experience, etc., to kind of take all of this out of your head, to basically to be able to best figure out, you know, what's important for you and what would make sense, you know, for me next. And at the end of then obviously I took a bit of leisure time, right? So I did a bit of kitesurfing, I did a bit of like cooking classes, but it was during COVID, so not a lot of travel, unfortunately. Basically end 2020, I was like, okay, so either I try to apply to be like a senior product manager at Stripe, or basically in a large, you know, fintech scaler, or I launch a new business. And I couldn't resist, I would say, the adrenaline of diving in again.
So then let's talk about diving again. Tell us about DeFacto. Why DeFacto out of all things? I mean, now is the second, you know, two startups that you've done, third rodeo. So obviously you were very well-versed, you know, you knew what the journey of building something from nothing looked like. So why DeFacto? What made you feel that the opportunity of DeFacto was meaningful enough for you to invest 200% of your time?
Yep. So first of all, we first decided to launch a company together with my two co-founders, and then we decided to launch DeFacto. So I think that the most important thing is the co-foundership and the people you're working with. This is the things that cannot move. And then, you know, the ideas, the project, the business model, whatever, you can iterate on that. So we really spend a lot of time, you know, discussing together with my two co-founders, aligning on the type of companies that we wanted to build, aligning on the ambition, etc., before launching the company. And I think we took about like 3 months to do so. But also there's a lot of serendipity in that. What are the odds to kind of, find someone that you get along with together, that you have fun working with, that you are complementary, that you have similar ambitions, similar, I would say, work-life targets, work-life balance targets, and I would say that you are available at the same times.
How did you meet them, by the way?
So there is Marco, he's a friend from school. So we both studied in France, and then we both studied in the Valley, and then Marco stayed in the Silicon Valley for about 10 years before moving back to France. And when he moved back, we kind of got in touch again. And then there's Morgan with a friend from Spendesk. So we used to work together, not directly in the same teams, but we used to get along well. And then she decided to also leave Spendesk to build a business together.
That's incredible. Now, for all of us, what is DeFacto? What are you guys doing at DeFacto?
Yeah, so what we're trying to do here is to kind of a, so first of all, we like the SMEs ecosystem in Europe. So at Spendesk, we kind of build a solution for SMEs. So we were in touch with like thousands of SMEs all across Europe, with their CEOs, with their CFOs, with their accountants, etc. And so we were, you know, offering them, I would say, a solution to better manage their purchases, like, you know, workflows, budgets, etc. But at the end of the day, you know, those guys, they would need cash to pay, right? And so when you take a look at the different solutions that exist today, it's mostly coming from banks. So it's like, credit lines or factoring, from banks. And it's pretty expensive and pretty heavy to set up. And so we were like, okay, so there's a huge need, you know, so working capital for SMBs. It's pretty, we thought that we could serve it, you know, like a quicker and nicer way. So it's huge in terms of like market size. For you to have an idea, working capital financing, it's 18% of the GDP in France. So it's like 500 billion euros that is factored every year. And that's for us the addressable market. So we were like, okay, that's a huge pain on a target that we like, that we start to know well, with solutions that are pretty old. So we tried to tackle this problem. So we're basically building a credit infrastructure to deliver, I would say, instant lending to SMEs all across Europe.
And how much capital have you guys raised to date?
Yeah, so we did, three series, one pre-seed and one Series A and one Series A extension. So we raised in total $25 million for equity. But the interesting aspect of us is that today we are doing so lending on our own balance sheet. We thought that if we really wanted to kind of change the user experience of lending, we needed to get a license ourselves and be the origin and be the lender of record. And so that's what we do. And so to basically lend to companies, you need to have money. And so we build, a line of debts of like more than 170 million euros to be able to lend this money to our customers.
That's amazing.
So we raised a lot of debt.
So I guess, when it comes to raising money, especially on the equity side, vision, is really what matters, no? And, whether you're looking to onboard investors, to onboard customers, employees, vision is key. So I guess in that regard, imagine if you were to go to sleep tonight and you wake up in a world where the vision of de facto is fully realized. What does that world look like?
So we believe that everything should be instant and moving toward instant things. So first of all, for example, when you try to watch a movie, you don't go to the Blockbuster anymore. You just go on Netflix. It's instant. When you want to send money to some friends, in France you use like Lydia. In the US it's Venmo, etc. It's instant. And it should be the same when you want to ship, when you want to order something on Amazon, you get it the next day. It's almost instant. And so we believe that to best pilot your business, you need to have like super reactive solutions in terms of like, engineering, servers, but also finance. And so what we try to do here is to be able to offer financing to any B2B transactions that occur online, in the most instant way. So it means that we need to engage with our customers where they are buying and selling their goods or services. We need to be able to underwrite, those guys and their counterparties in real time. And then we need to have investors that would trust us also in real time. And so we are basically building all these payment rails, all these financing rails to offer the most instant experience in lending, basically.
So then I guess in that regard as well, the question that I want to ask you is, thinking about the past, but then also with a lens of reflection, right? Imagine If I was to put you into a time machine and I bring you back to that moment where you were in Stanford, you were attending amazing lectures from the likes of Peter Thiel, you know, the investors of Google, all of that. And you were able now, you know, you're at the point where you're thinking about doing something of your own. And let's say you had the opportunity of having a sit down with that younger self and being able to give that younger self one piece of advice for launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
It's always a tough question, huh? You know, so when I joined my second job, after my first, I would say, failure experience, I did this kind of, utility matrix where I put criterias, for example, I don't know, the salary, the technology, the product, the people, etc. And I had like different opportunities and I tried to assess, you know, the opportunities based on those criteria. And then, you know, do a kind of a weighted average, of the ratings that I would put. And then it gave me, I would say, like a winner, and I picked it. I think one thing that I underestimated is the people, for sure. So you know, industry it's important, technology it's important, etc. But the most important thing I would say is the people you are working with. And if you need to be like a mix of like inspired and getting along well with each other, etc. And that's the things that that we should prioritize.
I love that. So Jordan, for the people that are listening, that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
Well, LinkedIn.
Easy enough. Well, Jordan, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an honor to have you with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening and see you at the next episode.